This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Summertime can be hard on parents. School's out and you have to find things for your kids to do. And what about when you're all on vacation together? What to do that's both entertaining and at least somewhat educational and won't bore the parents to tears? Many museums ramp up their programming at this time of the year to appeal to just such a clientele. Some of them hold summer camps, others have special activities geared towards day trippers. And many hope to lure those parents in along with their charges. Today on the program, we're going to pop around the state to peek in on just a few of the special educational offerings at museums in our region. Let us know what museum programs you love going to. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You can also tell us why you think this is important. Jim in Charlotte says creating intentional opportunities for exposure to new ideas outside of school can often lead to powerful and long-lasting learning. Museums can be so very impactful. Thank you, museum educators. So join Jim. Let us know your thoughts on why museum education is fun or what you do with your family. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're going to start today with Beth Roy, Director of Education at the Nature Museum in Grafton. Hi, Beth. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
So the Nature Museum at Grafton, not surprisingly, likes to explore the outdoor world. And every Thursday morning during the summer months, you have something called drop-in camp. And you actually have kids there today learning about trees?
Yeah, we do. Actually, we just finished up with them. They just headed out the door. But yeah, every Thursday we have kind of a drop-in. We call them our discovery days. And they're just meant to be really flexible for families. So you can kind of come right in off the street and join us for the morning. Or you can register ahead of time. And every week is a different theme. And they're basically age for kindergarten through third graders, but younger kids are welcome to come with their parents as well. So it gives a little break for parents to go grab a cup of coffee and their kids to kind of dive into nature for a few hours with us.
Yeah, you mentioned on the webpage that parents are free.
Yes, of course. We always welcome a little extra supervision.
So last week was your first drop-in camp of the year, and it was called Growing Up Fawn. What did the kids do?
We had a great time with those kids. We transformed ourselves into deer for a while there. So we have a puppet show that we always love to share with them. So we do that with, and that's great for all the ages. But we usually try to incorporate some outdoor time, running around, kind of games and things like that, as well as going and exploring in the woods. And then also we always try to incorporate some sort of craft. So for the kids for Growing Up Fawn, we actually headed out into the woods, and their challenge was to try to find enough food to survive if they were a deer for the winter. And so that's about 2.5 pounds of browse a day. So that's a lot of little sticks to go pick up.
So you made the kids go pick up 2.5 pounds of sticks?
Exactly. We had racing around, see how fast we could do, find all these little sticks, and we brought our little scale out to the woods to see how much of a pile it would be. And it was pretty amazing. I was amazed about how much we really needed to collect, so it was kind of fun just to run around the woods and, you know, have that kind of free exploration, but then also to have kind of a takeaway message with it as well.
I hope you didn't make them eat the sticks.
No. We try not to. Out there. But then we also did a really fun kind of tag game that tried to drive home the importance of why deer live in a herd. And so they were all pretending to be deers with their white flagging tails, you know, waving around. And then some kids were predators and they had to pretend to browse and not be tagged and all this stuff and try to warn each other. And it's just a great fun. And, you know, our hope for all of these kind of offerings is that, you know, kids have a really good time and just get to connect more to outdoors and to, you know, the amazing natural resources that Vermont has to offer. And hopefully they kind of take away some of those nuggets of nature knowledge as well.
You know, Beth, sometimes summer camps can be prohibitively expensive for families. Your drop-in camps are $10 for the day.
Yeah, that's the max they get. If you just walk in off the street, it's $10, and then it goes down to $8 if you actually register 24 hours ahead. So if you plan just a little bit ahead, you can get a discount there. So yeah, and also our kind of motto at the Nature Museum is that we don't want our programming, our pricing to be prohibitive to anybody. So if you truly want to come to our programming and price is an issue, then just talk to us and we want you here.
I really want to go to the August 7th camp, which is called Spiders and Spiderlings.
Yes.
So is Charlotte's Web, Charlotte, boy, I am a Vermonter now, is Charlotte's Web the advanced reading for that camp day?
Oh, it could be, I guess. I'm not sure. I think that would be awfully fun. Yeah, so we'll be just exploring the world of spiders and spiderlings out there. We have a great field behind the museum, so I'm sure we'll be looking around for spiders out there. And so we always try to get out there and looking. Like next week we'll be, focusing on frogs. And so, of course, we'll be heading to the pond and getting wet and looking for frogs and trying to catch them ourselves.
When you have something, though, like spiders and spiderlings, do you have trouble drawing the parents or convincing parents not to tell their kids, ew, before they even start?
Usually if they're here, they're already kind of on board with that. They're excited about it. And if the kids are getting excited, the parents, are usually pretty good about jumping on board too.
You mentioned that you think this is a great way for kids to get outside, get connected to nature, learn a little bit. Why is summer such a good time for this kind of learning for kids?
Sure. I think it's just a great time. Kids all need a little more unstructured time, and so summer's kind of, they can get away from that. And so I think it's just a great time to start winding down and focus on some different things. And, the traditional school topics are really important, but then summer is a really good time to delve into some of these other specialty topics that they may, find interesting.
Beth Roy is the Director of Education at the Nature Museum at Grafton. Beth, thank you so much for telling us about Drop-In Camp.
You bet, and I hope everyone can come and visit sometime.
We have a link, by the way, on our webpage if you're interested in the Nature Museum at Grafton, where we have links to all of the museums that we're going to be talking with today. And you can add your own thoughts there if you want to point out a museum in your neck of the woods that you think has great summer offerings. Go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition. You can add your thoughts there. Or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Jim in Proctor who says, the Vermont Marble Museum in Proctor is an amazing reminder of Vermont's industrial past. The museum is housed in a massive wooden factory perched over Vermont's largest waterfall, Sutherland Falls on the Otter Creek. Its exhibits explain how marble was quarried and finished locally and how these finished pieces of stone were used in the monuments around the country and the world. Let's turn now to Karen Peterson. She's Director of Education at the Shelburne Museum. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm great. How are
Good.
You?
I'm doing fine. I want to go to one of Beth's drop-in camps.
Well, there should be like an exchange. Museum educators get to
That's
do exchanges.
Right. Absolutely.
You have an event for families at the Shelburne Museum that's actually directly tied to one of the permanent exhibits at the museum. Can you talk a little bit about Circus Palooza?
I would be happy to. This year, it marks the fifth year that we've offered Circus Palooza, and it is a day when we turn the entire museum campus into a big top. We host wonderful circus performers from Troy Wonderly's Big Top Adventures. These are performers who've performed with Ringling Brothers and Cirque Eloise and Cirque du Soleil. So we have that 180-foot tent where they perform wrapped by the arms of our 525 circus building, which I can talk more about later. We also are offering a number of workshops for younger visitors that day, learning how to be a clown, how to become a carnival barker and play in theater games, tell stories of the circus. And then we're also hosting Modern Times Theater. They'll be performing in our brand new Pizzagalli Center for Art and Education, which is a wonderful year-round facility. So it actually allows us to introduce a little bit of air conditioning into a really warm and no doubt sunny Sunday afternoon on July 20th.
You know, there used to be that cliche that kids wanted to run away and join the circus, and that was more so in a time when the circus would come to town on the train and stop at little towns around the country. Do kids still have that fantasy?
You know, in watching the kids' faces when they watch the performers who are aerialists or acrobats or performing feats of strength or doing wild and crazy juggling, you can see the glimmer that would be really fun to do. They walk up to the performers afterwards if they're getting their autographs or want to talk to them, and they're really curious about sort of what that lifestyle might be. And sure, today's performers might not be participating in a know, a 2 mile long circus parade, but they are still on the road all the time. So I think it still has sort of that romanticism and cachet. And certainly their parents and grandparents, I think, are also thinking it would be a whole lot of fun.
How do you incorporate the historical artifacts that you have on display at the museum with the activities that you then hold for families?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, as I mentioned, the circus performance itself is amidst our incredible circus collection. So, for those folks who haven't been to the Shelburne, the circus building is a 525-foot building that houses an extraordinary and I just sort of superlatives kind of, you know, don't cut it, a superlative collection, the Roy Arnold Circus, which was carved by Roy Arnold and a small group of assistants. He spent 25 years hand-carving this circus of 129 units. It's got thousands of pieces. And it's on a scale, you know, 1 inch to 1 foot, it gives you the experience of walking along a 2 mile circus parade. So it really reflects the whole golden age of the circus. At the west end of the building is another hand carved circus, the Kirk Brothers Circus. That is 3,500 individual pieces that Edgar Kirk carved for his kids. What a great dad. I mean, what an amazing thing to have in your backyard in the course of the summer. So, you know, our visitors get the opportunity to see the performance today in contemporary life. Then they get to visit, you know, 20th century interpretations of the golden age of the circus. They get to see graphics. We have a poster collection of more than 500 woodcuts, lithographs, seriographs, many of which line the walls of our circus building. And we also have more than 40 carousel figures, which are also in that. Plus, you get to actually ride a working carousel. So it is sort of that seamless experience from looking at the historical object and then going out and experiencing the same thing that you're looking at. So it makes it feel much less disconnected and much more, a continuation of, oh, yeah, we can still do that today.
Well, Karen, what's the value of that? I mean, beyond that sort of, oh, cool factor, or I've got to do something with my kids, let's take them to the museum. What do you want? I mean, you're the director of education. You do a lot of educational programs at the Shelburne Museum. So what's the value?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the value is multifaceted. I mean, we are looking to create opportunities to connect our visitors with the joy and wonder of art. I mean, learning about, you know, the fact that art is personal, art is personal expression. It also allows us to have visitors practice close looking. You know, if you're looking at 3,500 hand-carved objects, you're able to hone in on what that elephant looks like and compare that elephant that Mr. Kirk carved to maybe that elephant that Mr. Arnold carved. So you're refining your critical thinking skills. All of this in the context of play. I mean, we want our visitors to come and enjoy what we're offering, experience the landscape and the gardens, but we're also offering opportunities for them to really engage, you know, both the historic world and their contemporary world with new eyes.
Are there any programs like this for adults? I mean, that would be valuable for more than just children.
Without a doubt. And I was going to say, you know, when you look at Circus Palooza, our audience is, we have 2,500 people, and what is great is the multi-generational aspect of that experience. I mean, we have lots of grandparents bringing their grandchildren, and so they're all, I think, experiencing that sort of newfound wonder in close looking. We also offer a lot of guided tours of numerous buildings. So even if you're coming to the museum on July 20th for Circus Palooza, you can also engage with one of our really knowledgeable visitor guides to explore our Impressionist collection. We have a wonderful exhibition of called In a New Light in our new Center for Art and Education, and we can walk visitors through that sort of same experience in looking at paintings in a fresh new way and comparing them. Normally, we have them housed in our Elektra Havemeyer Webb Memorial Building. Now they're in a gallery setting. So you're seeing them in a new light, and you're exploring, you know, the whole concept of Impressionism, which was brand new in the late 19th century. So our adult visitors have that opportunity, I think, through guided tours. We also offer a lot of other types of educational programming for our adult audiences, which includes a lot of lectures and symposia as well. And so not only do we offer it on the 20th for kids, we too have a great summer camp program. So our students also get a chance to explore our numerous other collections.
Well, you can hear the enthusiasm Karen has for education and for the exhibits at the Shelburne Museum. She's the director of education there. Karen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Jane. Really appreciate it. Take care.
That was Karen Peterson. We are talking today about museums. We have more museums, more fun coming up on Vermont Edition, and we'd love to hear from you. Maybe your family makes a pilgrimage to the Coolidge Historic Site on the 4th of July every year, where there are special activities, or your family loves to go to the Echo Aquarium to see the turtles and fish and run around and put hands in water. Wherever you are going this summer as a family, as adults, with your kids or without, to explore the educational offerings at museums around the region, we want to hear about it. Tell us about your favorite experiences, your favorite museums, and what you think the value is of having this special space to explore and learn during the summertime. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're exploring science, art, agriculture, and acrobatics with museum educators around the state. They're telling us about how they keep families entertained and informed with their summer programming. If you want to share what your museum or institution in your neighborhood does or what your family loves, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also go to Facebook. Maybe you're on there already thinking about summer plans, and pop on over to Vermont Edition's page and post your thoughts there. We got a note from a listener who uses the handle Labrapotes, who says, "The American Precision Museum in Windsor, Vermont is wonderful, especially when a good docent is milling around. The tiny model machines will captivate curious kids, and the story of those models may inspire kids with an enlarged sense of their own potential." Again, you can share your thoughts with us at vpr.net or by calling 1-800-639-2211. Greg DeFrancis is the director of education at the Montshire Museum of Science in Norwich. Hi, Greg. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
I want to hear about the Tinkering Lab.
Oh, the Tinkering Lab. Well, so the whole, as you know, the Montshire is a place where we tried to engage people in the actual act of doing science and engineering. That's why we exist. We want people to be outside on our nature trails and in Science Park and working with how to make dams in our stream and exploring fossils here at the museum, including our new the Tyrannosaurus Rex Sioux that we have this summer. And of course, engaging in all sorts of other aspects of doing. And tinkering is exactly that. It's a natural next step and gives a little bit more relevance to why people should try to figure some things out. It gives a little personal relevance of making a circuit for the sake of making a product that they can then enjoy, whether they take it home or whether they leave it behind. But it's something that they want to make, and they're going to struggle through all of that. So the Tinkering Lab is a new space that we'll be prototyping this summer for the first 2 weeks in August 5 through 18 or 17. And we're just exploring how do families work together in this kind of a space so that you have this social learning happening.
Well, give me an example of the kinds of things that kids will be able to create at the Tinkering Lab.
Yeah, so some of the things. So one activity that we've piloted several times, including with our Friday Night Teen Tinkering series we run at the museum for middle schoolers and high schoolers, as well as on the exhibit floor during some experimenting during the past March vacation and February vacations, is a device we call a Scribblebot. And so a Scribblebot is basically taking a motor, figuring out how to wire a motor in a complete circuit so the motor spins, adding some weight to the shaft of the motor in such a way that it does not spin smoothly. So think about when you have your laundry machine seeming to crawl across your laundry room floor because something is out of balance. And that jiggle, you put that onto some kind of a body that you make, a box, a cup, whatever it may be, and add legs to that, and the legs become markers. And then as this motor that you've completed and the motor spins and it's jiggling because it's the weight is offset with the markers on a white piece of paper draws beautiful patterns. So it's sort of combining art and whimsy and engineering and problem solving and perseverance, all while learning how to mess with circuits.
Yeah, you're also doing some stuff with LED lighting, right?
Yeah, and LED lights is another one that we do. Actually, one of the activities that we do sometimes with kids is called electronic bling. So in this case, you can end up making a ring or a hair clip or a Bapak patch that lights up and blinks. And that's just the trick there. Again, is like, how do you make a complete circuit? What do you need to do to make an LED light? How do you make a switch? How can you make it turn on and off? And then you're doing all this not just for the sake of learning how to make a complete circuit, but because you really want to make that cool bracelet that's going to light up and just sort of wow your friends. So another term for that is electronic bling.
Do parents ever have any qualms about their kids working with electricity?
Well, one thing that the quick answer is no, but more important is that this is not a kid's activity as much as a family activity. We really think it's important that learning happens across the generations. So we want the parents and the grandparents and the kids working together side by side, sometimes on their own individual projects side by side and sometimes as a group project, and they're sitting at the same table with other families. So not only is this social aspect of learning that we believe is really important occurring, but also there's even a community of learners as you're looking across the table and see a family who you don't know from the other side of the state trying and solving a problem a different way that that you're struggling with. So it's sort of a but the short answer to electricity and danger when we work with DC electricity and coin batteries, watch batteries, and AA batteries, there's not too much danger there.
I understand that when you're doing these kinds of things, you don't want to just have a handout sheet that says, here's how you build this thing. You're sort of asking families to use their imaginations and draw upon their skills and common sense to create these things. When you have all these generations doing it, who tends to really get into that style of things and who gets frustrated, the parents or the kids?
You know, it depends on the individual family. Sometimes the one thing we don't want to happen is for mom or dad to take over. We don't want our own education staff to take over. It really has to be from the kid or from the learner. And that frustration is such a fine line that we're towing, and that's a trick. We give very simple instructions and then a variety of examples of the kinds of directions that you could move towards. And people pick up on something and they'll go for it. Sometimes kids will try to tackle a project that is more complicated than at first appears and they need to tune it back. But again, if it's something they really want to complete because it has some personal meaning to them, they actually stick with it. And so the nice thing about tinkering or the whole maker movement is that it provides this relevance that helps kids learn to problem solve, helps them gain that attitude of how to persevere, and all those good things that we now the new lingo is referring to as grit. But it's a big piece that's really important, and those skills are critical for kids in the future.
And Greg, I also want to point out you have purposefully made these activities to be as gender neutral as possible because you want them to be appealing to both girls and boys, and not this sense of engineering is for boys or these are sort of gender specific.
Correct, exactly. And that's the nice thing about tinkering is you move it into some creativity, some whimsy, just wacky ideas, and there's something there for everyone. Another example of one of our tinkering lab activities we'll be doing this August, we call Electric Island. And this is a situation where people build houses, or maybe they build rocket ships, or maybe they build statues of liberty, maybe they build skateboard parks. They build something where they are engineering, constructing out of cardboard and paper and trying to figure out how to take this 2D material, turn it into a 3D structure. And then they are lighting it up with LEDs. And then they plug it into this little village that they set up. And over time, over the course of a day, you have this community-built village. And for some kids who always wanted to be bakers, they made a little bakery shop. And other kids who are skateboarders, they make the skateboard park, and they have a little lamppost hanging up over it. So there's something there because it's so open-ended that whether you're a boy or a girl, or whether you come from southern New England, or whether you're from northern New England or the North Country, there's something that you can find that's meaningful for you to build.
Well, I want to see that electric island when it's built. Greg DeFrancis is the director of education at the Montshire Museum of Science in Norwich. Greg, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Again, today we are talking about museum programs and museum education and what you can learn during the summertime when you've got the family out of school, maybe your family's on vacation and you've got a little extra time. What museums do you gravitate towards? Are you more of the outdoorsy type, science, tinkering? What do you do with your family? Post your thoughts at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. We got an email from the Dorset Historical Society. They say the Historical Society has a few programs each summer that kids love. Two hikes to historic Dorset quarries took place in June this year. But don't worry, the annual free ice cream social will take place next weekend on July 12th from 1 to 3 p.m. One treat for visitors is the model replication of an incline railway, which brought marble blocks down the side of Dorset Mountain in the late 1800s. And now we're going to turn to Megan Campbell, Coordinator of Interpretation and Education at the Billings Farm in Woodstock. Megan, nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you guys offer a week-long veterinary camp?
That's correct, yes. We have the wife of our farm manager is a veterinarian, and she was hired here in 2011 as our education assistant. And as we are always brainstorming and trying to improve and create new offerings, one of the things that she had thought about and suggested was a veterinary camp.
And what do kids think? Are they into it?
Oh, they are excited beyond belief about this program. We got an email from one of the parents of a student who just finished our camp in the end of June, and she says that her daughter came home and just couldn't stop talking about it, and the highest compliment she said was that they didn't treat us like little kids, Mom. They taught us how to do vet work, real vet work.
Well, along those lines, how do you make it so that kids get to experience some real stuff, some real veterinary experiences, and keep the experience both safe for the children, but also safe and not alarming for the animals that you're working with?
Mm-hmm. Well, our animals, first of all, are very used to being around people. Being a public institution as we are, the animals are very calm and very used to people being around them and petting them and touching them. We also have a fairly small staff to child ratio. We limit the number of participants to 20, and when they are working alongside the animals, they're usually in smaller groups of five students to work with the animals. Heather and the other staff that work with the kids, that the safety of the children and the safety of the animals is obviously a primary concern. So that's something that we speak to the participants about before we actually go into the area where they're going to be working side by side with the animals.
But there is a time when I think I was reading that you might like sedate a horse to do an exam, and the children get to experience that and can get really close to the animal.
Yes, that's a particular activity that we do on the day that is devoted to horses, and that's called floating the teeth to do an oral exam and floating the teeth. The horse is generally sedated, and so Dr. Heather does that sedation, you know, with the children there to see, and then they go about doing an oral exam on the horse. And part of the reason that the horse is sedated is because the teeth need to be filed down. And so it's an opportunity then for the children to see how that's done, why it's done, And they actually get to, you know, safely put their hand and a good portion of their arm into the mouth of a large draft animal.
So I can see why that would be pretty thrilling for kids, but
Absolutely.
Do they get jazzed when you say, today we're going to talk about poultry diseases?
Yes, actually they do. You know, and because it's something that the students that are coming here are so interested in what a veterinarian really does, and that they understand that a veterinarian has to know all of those diseases and how to diagnose them and how to treat them. So yeah, they are pretty jazzed about that.
So is the goal here to create little veterinarians, or is there something more broad that you're trying to do?
Well, it is a twofold fold goal. There are fewer and fewer large animal veterinarians being trained and going out into the workforce. So that is certainly a goal, to get them interested and excited and perhaps learn a little bit more about what that field has to offer. But also it's to foster an appreciation and understanding of the importance of all animals, not just farm animals, and the care and well-being of all animals.
Megan Campbell is the coordinator of interpretation and education at the Billings Farm in Woodstock. Thanks so much for talking about your veterinarian camp.
You're welcome.
And let's go to Jesse, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Jesse. You there, Jesse?
Thanks.
Yeah, yes, go right ahead. Hi.
Well, here in Brattleboro, we all love this education center that's called Beak, up on the top of the mountain on Bonnievale Road. It's called Bonnievale Environmental Education Center. I wish that they will be able to duplicate the workshop series they had last month on pollinators.
Hmm.
It turns out, aside from helping people who are worried about the threats to bees and about flutterbys, they empowered us to know about making growing a more effective pollinator's garden, because it turns out the perennials that are available from large-scale growers are mostly treated with pesticides and not good for pollinators.
Huh. So did you attend this workshop, Jesse?
Yeah. There were a series of them. They're working in concert with four other environmental centers in Windham County.
Huh.
And I'm just hoping that it was successful, but I think it bears repeating because, you know, we all care about bees.
Well, Jesse, thanks for telling us about that BEEC, the Brattleboro Environmental Education Center workshops on pollination that they did last month. And Jesse brings up a good point to end things on, that, you know, if we want to have these educational programs, I guess we have to have attendance. And so we're talking today about some of the great things that you can do in the summertime to encourage learning for your family, lifelong learning and summertime learning. One more note before we go. We got a note from Peter, who wrote to us about the Lydia Spitzer Demonstration Forest in East Charleston. Peter says, this is sort of an outdoor museum for landowners, students, and teachers, as well as forestry professionals. Want to know how to manage your forest for wild birds? The forest provides firsthand examples of applied stewardship practices. It's accessible through four-season trails and interpretive signage. And don't forget, you can add your own museum activities or favorite family adventures to our webpage. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Coming up this year, the Vermont Humanities Council has sponsored public readings of a seminal speech by Frederick Douglass, who escaped slavery and became a noted abolitionist in the 1800s. We'll find out why his speech, The Meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro, has value today. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For the last couple of years, an event has been staged on Boston Common on the 4th of July. It's a communal reading of Frederick Douglass's 1852 speech, The Meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro. This year, the Vermont Humanities Council has sponsored readings of the speech here. Paul Marcus organized the project. He says the Douglass speech is a critical text in American history, but one that isn't well known to many Americans. Marcus says reading it aloud in public adds depth to our celebrations of American independence. Here's an excerpt from the speech.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour.
That's pretty damning.
Yes.
So why did you choose that passage? What do you think that illuminates?
Well, for me, and I think a big piece of what this event is about, it's both getting in touch with the historical context of what Douglass was talking about and also looking at the meaning of Douglass's words for today. And it seems we as a nation are not willing to look at all of our history. And so I've had experiences where I've been talking to someone about the history and about slavery, and they say, stop dwelling in the past. And it's those same people that will be out tomorrow celebrating the 4th of July, very happy to celebrate the past. But we seem to be willing to take those things that we consider positive and good about our past and hold them up and celebrate them. But we don't or aren't willing to really look at the whole reality of our history, because the flip side of those things is a history of genocide and enslavement. And you know, that history allows this nation to be what it is.
Paul, take us back to 1852 then, and to Frederick Douglass, who was asked to speak in Rochester on July 5th, and this is the speech that he gave.
Well, he was, you know, the little of this history that we do get taught, I think most people know who Frederick Douglass was. He was an escaped slave who self-educated and then eventually connected with the abolition movement, particularly with William Lloyd Garrison. So it's 1852. We're at a time, you know, as the nation was expanding westward, the issue of slavery became very central. And there's a series of compromises that happen from 1789 up until the time of the Civil War. And what had just happened prior to that was the there was the Compromise of 1850, and then there was the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And one of the things that happened in the Kansas-Nebraska Act is it really strengthened the fugitive slave law. And the fugitive slave law is really written into our Constitution, although not explicitly, which is Douglass comments on.
Yeah.
And so it was a time where slave catchers could, I don't like using the term slave, I tend to use the term enslaved because it's a much more active term. It talks about something being done to people rather than just the passive term slave. But slave catchers could come up and just grab anybody. And I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people may have seen 12 Years of Slaves, which speaks to that very strongly. And this really caused and really rallied people in the North against the system of slavery. And it doesn't necessarily mean, and it's interesting because Douglass was connected to the abolitionist movement, and we have the sense that, you know, all abolitionists weren't necessarily anti-racist. A large portion of the abolitionist movement wanted to just felt the best thing for blacks would be to move them to Africa, back to Africa. And many were still very bigoted. And, you know, one wing of the abolition movement was much more what we might think of as explicitly anti-racist today. And so Douglass, in his speech, he was invited by the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in Rochester. And he spoke in Corinthian Hall to probably 500 or 600 people. And actually, that was a pretty friendly audience, and for the most part, his speech was well received. And it was also, I think, printed in 40 different newspapers, and a pamphlet of it was produced and sold as well.
And it was well received. I mean, he starts out by extolling the virtues of the United States and then says, you know, these don't apply to us, to me, to
right.
people who are enslaved. And it's a sham to have somebody like me want to celebrate Independence Day, because independence from what? And it is that passage that you read is pretty damning. So it was received well.
It's very damning. Well, at least the accounts at the event, he received an ovation. You know, it was a relatively friendly audience in the sense that it was the Ladies Abolitionist Society mm-hmm. meeting, mm-hmm. 4th of July meeting. By the way, the event was held on the 5th that year because the 4th fell on a Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and they wouldn't celebrate that on the Sunday. So in that sense, I can't imagine everybody walked out of there, you know, thinking, wow, this was amazing. But at least the historical evidence indicates that at the event, it was well received. Douglass is quite well known. He lived in Rochester. He was publishing his paper, The North Star, at that time. It's interesting because Douglass basically says that the Constitution doesn't sanction slavery. And he has hopes for both the Constitution. It was very clear the abolition movement and a lot of enslaved African Americans and all the movements that were happening, they latched on to the words of the Declaration of Independence. And Douglass certainly does this. You know that how could you have talked about being enslaved by England while you're enslaving people here in this country? And Douglass seemed to say that he found hope in the Constitution, whereas William Lloyd Garrison felt that, I don't remember the exact quote, I think he said that it was a pact with the devil and should be burned, because he felt that the Constitution sanctioned slavery. And certainly there's at least three places in the Constitution where that's the case.
Paul, you have helped organize readings of this speech in Massachusetts, including one on Boston Common that happens each year now on the 4th of July, and you've now helped to organize the ones that are being conducted around Vermont this year. Why do you think it's valuable to read this speech out loud and think about it on the 4th of July?
Mm-hmm. I think, as I said at the beginning, we're not in touch with that history. My dear friend and mentor, Horace Selden, who's the founder of Community Change, the organization that I was executive director of until the end of last year, always talked about the idea that our nation was founded on a terrible contradiction. And on the one hand, all quote-unquote men are created equal, and on the other hand, that's clearly not true. And he said that the resolution of that contradiction is a struggle for the soul of the nation. And we're still locked in trying to resolve that contradiction, and for part of that we have to be in touch with our history, and we have to understand the impact and the connection of the history to the present day. You know, yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act, and this year is also the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board, and there's a lot of anniversaries around the civil rights movement that are coming up. But when we look across the nation and we look at the outcomes from all systems, if we think education, housing, healthcare, jobs, wealth creation, the gaps in those areas, the racial disparities in those areas, have since the civil rights movement have either stayed the same or have gotten worse. And so this is still a major issue facing the country. And I think that coming together, these events, people actually, we have copies of the speech that have numbered sections. They're abridged copies because I think the original speech was probably an hour and a half or so. And people come up to the mic or sit in a circle, and each person gets to read a section of the speech. And we all get to hear it together and in some cases get to talk about it afterwards. And it's an opportunity to be able to reflect on Douglass's words and hold, as we celebrate the 4th of July tomorrow, I hope that the people who are participating in these events and who read this speech will also have Douglass's words in their hearts and minds.
What have they told you so far from the ones that you've done about what it feels like?
Well, we did an event in St. Johnsbury on the 1st. There was an event on the 1st in St. Johnsbury, and there was one in Brattleboro. And one woman talked about the fact that she had never heard this speech and how come this isn't being taught in every classroom. A number of people reflected in the past that from their perspective, the speech totally speaks to the reality of the presence of today. And, you know, I would say the process of reading the speech together and coming together really provides an opportunity to have the discussions that are so rare around these issues.
Paul Marcus is the organizer of the Vermont Humanities Council's communal readings of Frederick Douglass's 1852 speech called The Meaning of the Fourth of July for the Negro. Several of the readings have already happened, but there's one in Burlington on July 8th, and we have more information about that at vpr.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we are off for the 4th of July. At noon, though, VPR will have a special called Reveal. It's a new pilot from the Center for Investigative Reporting and from PRX. And at 7 p.m., we'll be airing the Capitol Steps Politics Takes a Holiday special. Join us again Monday. We're going to talk about how to identify which teens might become problem drinkers, some new research out by UVM. You're going to want to tune in for that on Monday. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, along with Catherine Hayes. Peter Biello directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.